Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. Yes, we live in a confused culture, and the world is crazy because of it. Fortunately, we still have the wisdom, knowledge, and understanding of King Solomon to help us make sense of all these things. A reminder again, if you missed a show or want to share the show with somebody, go to our website, solomononblast.com. All the latest shows are there, along with the Solomon on Blast blog. We'll probably have an update there this week for that. You can also check out the links page. We have links to some of our favorite sites, our sponsors, so check that out. And as always, if you want to stream us live, go to powertalk1210.com. And you can find links there to other shows that are on the station at other times. If you want to listen to some of the great interviews that Jim Parisi does on his show, there's a little cloud icon there that'll take you to the SoundCloud link. You can hear interviews with people like Donny Osmond and Stephanie Powers, and a lot of other ones. Probably people that are even more modern than that, or more current. But they're great interviews, so you can check those out too. And if you want to send us an email, don't forget our email address, solomon@solomononblast.com. During the show here, you can join us in the discussion by calling us 520-750-7456. Like I said, it's a crazy upside-down world out there, but hopefully with Solomon's wisdom, we can turn it right side up for at least a little while here this morning. Solomon's voices the same sentiment about the times he lived in. He says in Ecclesiastes 12:8, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "all is vanity." But he just doesn't leave it at that. He goes on and gives us his answer to address that problem. He says, "Because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find acceptable words, and what was written was upright, words of truth." That's really what we're looking for, is words of truth. But sometimes people don't want to hear the truth, and Solomon even understands that, because he then writes, "The words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd." He says words are like goads, in other words, a painful poke against the backside to keep us heading in the right direction. But he also understood that not everything written was going to be upright and words of truth, because he follows up by saying, "And further, my son, be admonished by these, of making many books there is no end, and much study is wearisome to the flesh." So the question is, how do you determine out of all those books and writings that exist what is and isn't the truth? It can be a difficult task. Whose recommended reading list do you use to determine what to read? Is it the old school standbys, the New York Times bestseller list, or Book of the Month Club? Is it Oprah's recommended reading list? Or is it Amazon.com today? I'm sure there are thousands of reading lists if you were to Google it. The key is finding books that don't end up being a waste of time, because Solomon did say, "Of making many books there is no end, and the study is wearisome to the flesh." So we don't want to get tired out from it. There's nothing worse than finding a book and thinking it's supposed to be good, and after reading it, you realize it's a total waste of time. And the thing is, when you start out reading it and it's not good, you think, well, maybe it'll get better. So you keep reading it, and by the time you finish it, hoping it would get better, you realize that, yeah, it was a total waste of time. So how do you answer that question on determining what is and isn't a good book? One option might be to read the book, How to Read a Book. That's the title of the book, How to Read a Book, The Classic Guide to Intelligent Reading by Mortimer J. Adler and Charles Van Dorn. The book actually outlines, like the title says, how to read a book. So it's a good reference point to start with, and might want to check that one out. So no matter what, though, discussing what you read is an important part of reading, whether it's a book, an article, magazine, newspaper. Does anybody read the newspaper anymore? Okay, maybe online or something on the internet. Isaac Watts, in his book, Improving the Mind, he makes a great statement that I really like. When I read it, it's one of those gems that if you get nothing else out of the book other than that one thought, it was worth reading. He says, "A man of vast reading without conversation is like a miser who lives only to himself. And I think, at least for me, that's a good description of why we do this show, to have conversations that everyone can benefit from. So when we come back from the break, we'll take a look at the latest writings of, yes, the President of the United States. We'll be right back. Oscar, can you get the president in here? We're ready for him now.
Okay.
No, we're not going to have the president in the studio today, unfortunately. It'd be interesting to have a few questions for him.
My fellow Americans.
Ecclesiastes 8:4 says, "Where the word of a king is, there is power, and who may say to him, 'What are you doing?'" Well, I think that's my question. What are you doing? Everybody knows that we had the State of the Union address from President Obama this past week and made a lot of promises or put out a lot of offers as to what he thought we needed to do. A lot of it had to do with middle class and the economics of our time. He said middle class economics means helping working families feel more secure in a world of constant change. That means helping folks afford childcare, college healthcare, a home, retirement, and my budget will address each of these issues, lowering the taxes of working families and putting thousands of dollars back into their pockets each year.
Well, Doug, I think, you know, as we discuss this, one of the things that people need to pick up on right away when you start hearing this kind of rhetoric is that these guys have a different definition of the middle class. Traditionally, the middle class is based on the independent citizen, not a wealthy person, not somebody, you know, who's particularly privileged, but a person who works hard and has created for themselves a life, a home, you know, decisions that they've empowered themselves to make decisions where they're able to take charge of their own lives. And so that has been the traditional definition of the middle class. These guys have the Marxist definition of the middle class. And
classic one, which says that the state will take care of you.
Yeah, well, what I'm trying to say is, you know, even the phrase that the Marxists used to throw out about the middle class, the bourgeoisie, that sounds like such a fancy term for people of privilege. But actually, the word bourgeois is just the French word for burger, or which just means citizen, a townsperson. Mm-hmm. And basically, that was the middle class. This is why they hate the middle class, in fact. They don't want people to be independent. They don't want people making their own decisions. They don't want people thinking that they don't need the government. They need the government in everybody's life in order to control, basically, you know,
the life of
the masses.
Yeah. And there's a book that I wanted to reference called The Law, written by Frederick Bastiat back in 1845 time frame, roughly. He was a French citizen. He'd actually been in the politics in France at that time. And this book, The Law, really talks a lot about what is the law supposed to be, what is the government, the state supposed to be. There's a foreword in there by Walter E. Williams, and in the book, Bastiat says, "See if the law takes from some persons what belongs to them and gives it to other persons to whom it does not belong. See if the law benefits one citizen at the expense of another by doing what the citizen himself cannot do without committing a crime." And Bastiat defines that as legal plunder, legalized theft. And really, that is what was premier in my mind in the speech that was given by the president.
Right. You know, he's talking about a Messiah complex, probably better described as a Robin Hood complex.
Yeah. And that was the statement I heard on a lot of the news channels, that it was going to be his Robin Hood speech, not the State of the Union speech.
And as if he possesses this authority to literally go in and plunder people that have made money and pass it out. Again, the real point is that what has made America great is an independent middle class. People, they're not necessarily rich, but they do have enough to make their own choices and decisions about their lives. And this is the greatest threat to the idea that government needs to rule everything.
Yeah, and if you get a chance, this is a great book to read because, like I said, he really defines what is a just and an enduring government, and it is in direct opposition to everything that was presented, or most everything that was presented in Obama's State of the Union address. He talks about the fact that you have to have a system of legal laws that represent the people's rights, not a system of laws that take away some person's right in order to give it to somebody else. So,
well, you know, just to give a one point of view on it, it looks to me like the entire strategy of the progressive wing of the Democrat Party is basically to join the rich and the poor against the middle class. But, you know, you try just bringing into the conversation the fact that they're saying that Hillary Clinton, for example, is putting together a historically large war chest for this upcoming 2016 presidential election. I mean, if these people really represented the poor, they're not getting little donations, you know, on the street corners here. These people represent the wealthiest of the wealthy. We're talking about Hollywood and you know, billionaires and corporations, and yet they give us the rhetoric like they're fighting for the little guy, when in fact they're simply taking people that feel probably, you know, in poverty, you feel desperate. Those are the people that pick up your cause for you and become your, you know, your foot soldiers.
Yeah, and your point you made with regards to their view of the middle class, Bastiat makes a good statement in here that is pretty much exactly what you're saying. He says, and remember, this was written back in late 1800s. He says, open it at random any book on philosophy, politics, or history, and you will probably see how deeply rooted in our country is this idea. And the idea he's referring to is socialism. And he says, the child of classical studies, the mother of socialism, in all of them, you will probably find this idea that mankind is merely inert matter receiving life, organization, morality, and prosperity from the power of the state. And that's basically what we're talking about here, is that, you know, you're just a lump of clay and the state has to make you achieve what you can achieve. And without the state, you're never going to be able to do that. And that flies in direct opposition to what the Constitution put in place, which was life, liberty, pursuit of happiness.
Well, and this is also why religion is something that they absolutely despise and must destroy it with any credit, you know, with its platform and any credibility that it has in society, because they know as long as people look to God before they look to government, that religion will always displace government as the most important factor in their lives as they develop and qualify, you know, what they believe is true.
Right. So, yeah, if you sit down and take the time and look at the speech without the audio or the video part of it and really read the words and then look at something like the Constitution and this book, The Law, you'll find out that he's directly opposition to what this country was built on. We'll be right back with our next segment. We're back with Solomon on Blast. Yes, Jesus loved me. The Bible tells me so. That's what the song says. Well, in Proverbs, Solomon says, they will call on me, but I will not answer. They will seek me diligently, but they will not find me. Because they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord, they would have none of my counsel and despise my every rebuke. Why do I say that? Well, there's an article by Kurt Eichenwald in Newsweek that says the Bible is so misunderstood, it's a sin, at least according to Kurt Eichenwald. Now, when you read through this, he's pretty much attacking every aspect of the Bible that he can. He makes it out that the whole entire thing is can be considered a book of lies, he even states. And I have to say, where does he get his information from? And when you start looking through this particular article, he actually references books written by or comments made by a couple different professors. One of them is a gentleman by the name of Professor Bart Ehrham, who is, I think, a supposed scholar of the Bible, and he's written a number of books. But when you look at his background, he's really an agnostic, or in some cases, very much against the Bible.
Well, look at it, the first line of the article here in Newsweek. By the way, they have a habit of putting out all the magazines, front page articles on the Bible or religion, usually at Christmas and at Easter, because they understand that all the people they're mocking here will buy them just because they see a Bible. That's why they do it. It's the highest sales time of the year. If you put a Bible or something religious, Christianity, on your cover, the chances of selling the magazine go way up. But the first line of this article, he says, they wave their Bibles at passerby screaming condemnations of homosexuals. So the first sentence tells you that this article is not going to go very well.
Well,
if you're looking for an encouraging article on the Bible,
or if you're looking for an unbiased view of the Bible. And further in the article, he says, Newsweek's exploration here of the Bible's history and meaning is not intended to advance a particular theology or debate the existence of God. Rather, it's designed to shine a light on a book that has been abused by people who claim to revere it but don't read it, in the process of creating misery for others. But in reality, when you look through this article, he's really trying to tear apart the Bible and claim that it's not God's word.
Yeah, it's modern influence. And so there's so many layers here that are...
And the writer is not in any way a theologian.
Right, that he's a business writer.
Yes.
That are superficial. But, for example, to ignore 2,000 and then you add the Jewish history, 3,000 plus years of interpreting the Bible and certain precedents of morality and certain conclusions drawn from the Bible. These conclusions were not drawn by a couple of hicks in Alabama with a truck engine sitting in the front yard. I mean, this is how they try to make it look like these kinds of people just have this bizarre take on the scriptures. We're talking about thousands of years of precedent and some of the great minds in the history of the world looking at these ideas, examining the scriptures, coming to certain conclusions, not just of one type of worship or one type of persuasion, but in several, drawing the same conclusions on these matters that he's obviously attacking right out of the gate.
Right, and he tries to use the whole telephone game cliche to say that the Bible's not accurate. In the article, he says, no television preacher has ever read the Bible, neither has any evangelical politician, neither has the Pope, neither have I, neither of you. At best, we've all read a bad translation, which he claims is a translation of translations of translations. And he goes on to actually state that, there were professional scribes that were recording and scribing the Old Testament, but when you look at the New Testament and the letters, he says that it was amateurs that handled that job. It wasn't professionals. And they didn't start copying the letters and testaments until centuries after they were written, is his comment.
I guess until he came along, it's a good thing he came along to enlighten the rest of us, right?
Exactly.
Humanity has been so dumb.
Yeah.
And before this man's... ability to tell us about what life's really about.
All right. We'll come back with more discussion on it right after these commercial breaks. Okay, we're back with Solomon on Blast. And like I said, Solomon did say that they will have none of my counsel and despise my every rebuke. And that really seems to me to directly apply to what this guy is addressing in his article. He just continues to claim that they're throughout the article that it's a bad translation and everything in there is a lie.
Well, there's a technical term here without going too deeply into it, and the term is gematria. The Hebrew and the Greek languages both have a gematria, which means a number system, that each letter in their alphabet has a numeric value. For example, Hebrew has 22 characters in the alphabet. They have final versions, but basically 22. And the first nine are 1 through 9. The second nine are 10 through 90. And the last four are 100 through 400. And so basically when you translated a Hebrew scripture, you were able to do the math at the end of that scripture to make sure that it was understood correctly. It wasn't that, what did you say? Well, you know, I said, you know, no adultery. It's not what you really said. And you can get that idea, but people from the past are not as dumb as we like to think.
And I think that's what he really points out in this particular section. He says that these guys were just amateurs. They didn't know what they were doing.
Well, by today's standards, everybody was an amateur. Right. You know, if you didn't go to an Ivy League school like he did, how could you possibly be as smart as him?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it's the whole mentality is that these people are basically assuming that anybody that came before them couldn't have possibly had the grasp that they do on life and truth.
And the other part of this article that I see that really makes it out that it's not balanced, like I stated up front, was he references just two different authors and their specific books. And my thought was when I read through this was, well, is he providing a view of what the Bible is or isn't, or is he just doing a book review for this guy to promote his viewpoint out of his book? Like I said, the one that's Dr. Bart Ehrman, he's written a number of books, but he's very much the agnostic, all against the truth of the Bible, even though he writes and makes a lot of money, I'm sure, in writing all these books. And it just seems like typically these articles are focused on one particular aspect, one particular person, and they throw out, like you said, thousands of years of analysis, biblical analysis, and any other theologian that might have a viewpoint different than what he came into this article with. And his viewpoint was, how do I tear it apart? And so he found the exact right authors to go look in their books and address the issue that way rather than looking at it from a broader perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's beginning with a very current political, controversy by talking about, I'm sure he's talking about the evangelical position on gay marriage as opposed to traditional marriage. And so right away, he makes it clear this is not about the traditional sacred scriptures. This is about the current political environment, and I'm going to do my best to demean those people that hold, this position. You know, there's a great line that C.S. Lewis used to use for this kind of thinking. He called it the snobbery of chronology. That, you know, the belief that because we live so long after our distant ancestors, we must be that much wiser, better, and different than they were, you know. And, you know, this is basically the snobbery of chronology in play, so he can assume that all the people of the past were completely lost. And now that we have all this technology and other abilities to to investigate that somehow we must be right and they must always be wrong. But I don't think those people were as benighted as he assumes they were.
Yeah. Well, the author of that book that he references, this Dr. Erhem, he made a comment when he was being interviewed with regards to his book, and the interviewer had asked him about whether, you know, does the Bible contain lies? And his response was that he says, I don't prefer the word lies. What I prefer is the word forgeries. A forgery is when somebody writes a book claiming to be somebody else. And I think he should look at himself when he makes that statement. He's writing a book claiming to be an expert on the Bible when in reality he's really somebody that's looking to disavow the Bible and not be a true expert on it.
What's his name? The writer. Now that he's been imbued with so much courage to take on religion, I think he should write something about the Quran. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that would be a good thing.
I think
for
he
him
should
to
just take it on.
And fact, let the
go to the Middle East and right away, man. Take it to task.
And you know what?
By these same standards. Just go after it.
Right. And you look at this particular article, and there are pictures associated with it. Right. It's not just text in the Newsweek article. And some of the pictures aren't in all cases positive with regard to what the Bible is. So if he's going to write that same article, I'm sure he should include some appropriate material and pictures and whatnot of the Prophet Muhammad. Maybe it won't look so great. And
absolutely.
See what the results come out to
he
be.
He had to go shore under the operation in Paris at Charlie Hebdo. Maybe together they can really take this thing on, blow the cover off of it. What do you think?
Yeah. And see whether
absolutely.
They agree with them.
They're so bold and so brash. But in reality, these people are only able to attack soft targets because, again, they know that what we will do as Christians is we'll talk about it. We might snicker a little bit, and that's it. It's over. It means nothing else other than it's between him and God at the end of the day, as much as he would probably despise hearing such a statement.
And the interesting thing is he also brings out the point that when they did the translation of the New Testament, that there weren't a lot of words that had that in English that had the equivalent, so they had to quote make up words, and he uses that as if it were a negative with respect to our Bible, when in reality our English language is derived.
Yeah,
right?
It's an astonishing thing. It demonstrates an astonishing impact.
Right. The
that the Bible is made upon cultures around the world.
Yeah, we think English is kind of the premier language and has all this history to it, but when you consider the fact that it was the Bible, the translation into English that created the language that we have, you have to say there's something very, very incredible there in the depth of knowledge and understanding that the Hebrew and the Greek languages had that didn't exist in the barbaric English language that existed at that time.
Absolutely. And just kind of to make a comment about Newsweek magazine running the article, not just the writer himself, makes you understand pretty clearly why they no longer have a print edition available with this kind of reporting. It seems like they're fading pretty fast as a credible magazine and news source.
And the other author that he referenced, Jason Bedehun, he's a professor of religious studies right here in Arizona at NAU. He says that the goal of the translators was actually to create a Bible that was a gorgeous work that was very accurate in its translation and clear in its meaning, but that didn't happen, at least according to this professor. He says the King James Bible is a beautiful piece of English literature. In terms of the other two goals, however, the translation falls far short. Well, I think I go back to Solomon and those that at some point they'll call on him, but he's very likely not to answer because they despised my every rebuke. So we'll come back.
They have a personal agenda, plain and simple.
And that was obvious. from that article.
Exactly.
So don't believe everything you read. Take it with a grain of salt. We'll be back with more of Solomon on Blast right after this. We're back, Solomon on Blast. Proverbs 18:11, Solomon says, "The rich man's wealth is his strong city, and like a high wall in his own esteem." So my question is for listeners and everybody else out there, whose book recommendations do you look to? Bill Gates has his book recommendations out there and being the richest man in the world. Is it worth taking a look at what he recommends, and is it worth reading what he's recommending? So I took a look. 2014, he has a blog, Six Books I Recommend by Bill Gates. And so as you would expect, there's some business books on there. The first one, Business Adventures by John Brooks. And he says that Warren Buffett recommended that book to him back in 91. And he thinks that's still the best business book he's ever read. Stress Test by Timothy Geithner. The central irony of Stress Test is that the guy who was accused of being a lousy communicator as the U.S. Treasury Secretary has penned a book that is such a good read. So it's Geithner giving you his viewpoint on the whole blow up of the global financial crisis that occurred. Whether you want to read that one or not. This one seems like a pretty decent reference. The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a pretty good book that might be worth reading. The Rosie Project, that's a novel, so not really looking much at the novels.
I have here in front of me other people's favorite book. For example, this might be meaningful to us. Barack Obama's favorite book is The Song of Solomon. Not the one by Solomon, though, the one by Toni Morrison.
Really?
Written in 1977. So that's his, you know, I don't know.
It's on his list.
Yeah, that's his kind of wisdom. Stephen King, I thought, is interesting. His favorite book is The Lord of the Flies. Now, that's an outstanding book by William Golding. The story, I think it's a Bible analogy, actually, in my opinion. I don't know. But I think that's pretty good. Here's another one, Tom Clancy. His favorite book is 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea by Jules Verne. So you can see how those books influence these
different people.
Yeah, influence their lives and how they approached, you know, their callings.
Right. And now in the president's State of the Union address, he made a statement about the fact that climate change was going to be a significant issue, right? That's one of our biggest threats. Now, then surprisingly, or not surprisingly, on Bill Gates's recommended reading list is a book called The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert. It's climate change is a big problem, one of the biggest we'll face this century, but it's not the only environmental concern on the horizons. And he says, humans are putting down massive amounts of pavement, moving species around the planet, overfishing, acidifying the oceans, changing the chemical composition of rivers, and more. So it's a book on climate change and how that's going to cause a completely unnatural history in our world. And the question is, you know, is he reading this in order to understand the president's point, or is the president getting directed by those with the money to say, this is what you need to be focusing on because that's what we believe in?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy. When you think about that and you compare it to the doctrines of evolution, I mean, there's such a massive contradiction between believing we're causing climate change and believing that the Earth is 4 billion years old. I mean, if the Earth is 4 billion years old, I think it's going to find a way to survive us, don't you think?
I think so. And their whole issue of the global warming, what was it, 1.4 degrees, the warmest on record. And I have to think, you know, is it like a Gallup poll, plus or minus 3%, or 3, you know, what is their margin of error on that 1.4 degrees? If it's plus or minus 3 degrees, I'm not too concerned.
Yeah, you know, the politics of it are global by implication. I mean, they have agreed that they're going to pursue this course and make sure that they're able to, grab all the monies that are going to support it. And they'll use those monies any way they feel they need to.
Yeah, and the last one on the list from Mr. Gates here, reinventing American healthcare, how the Affordable Care Act will improve our terribly complex, blatantly unjust, outrageously expensive, grossly inefficient, like his title, error-prone system by Ezekiel J. Emanuel, who was one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act. So he's going to tell us in that book how great the Affordable Care Act
Doug,
actually is.
So, Doug, what's your favorite book?
My favorite book, I would have
not
to say...
Not including the Bible.
Not including the Bible. I would have to say from the point of view of really understanding our world today in terms of the United States and our economy and everything is The Law by Frederick Bastiat. Even Walter Williams says it was one of the most clarifying books he's ever read. So that's my vote for this week. We'll be right back with our One Greater Than Solomon segment. We're back with Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. Fire! One Greater Than Solomon segment. This article comes last week. Atlanta mayor denies religious motives in fire chief's termination. The Atlanta mayor, Kasim Reed, fired... This is going to be difficult because there's a lot of fire in here. Fired the fire chief, Kelvin Cochran, on Tuesday over a spat that started with a faith-based book and ended with LGBT activists demanding swift punishment. Cochran's self-published book, Who Told You You Are Naked, tells the story of his faith in Christ, but also includes comments supporting traditional marriage, Orthodox Christian teachings on sexuality. During the news conference to announce the firing, Reed emphatically denied Cochran lost his job over his religious beliefs. He insisted he relieve the fire chief of his command because of what amounted to insubordination, saying, "This has nothing to do with his religious beliefs. It has everything to do with the decision to publish a book with the contents of this book without talking to your boss, period." Now, it's self-published. It has nothing to do with him as a fire chief, by the sounds of it. It has everything to do with his, as it says, the story of his faith in Christ. So to be fired for that particular reason and claiming that it's because he published the book seems a little disingenuous here. The mayor also said he resented the backlash he had endured from Cochran's supporters, many of whom called the mayor at home during the Christmas holiday. He claimed that more than one person called him the Antichrist. So this is what Chief Cochran brought to my door, Reed said. And the mayor claimed he only found out about the book late last year, although it was actually published in 2013. He suspended him for 30 days and then while they investigated. But during that time, LGBT activists lobbied for Cochran's firing. And the gentleman, Jeff Graham, who leads the group Georgia Equality, said the chief's continued leadership would have a, quote, chilling effect, unquote, on all city employees. Now, I don't know, maybe that'll stop
fires. Well, having
fires.
A chilling effect is really not such a bad quality for a fire chief.
No,
actually.
That's what I'm thinking.
They're there to put out fires. But this is ridiculous. This is a First Amendment free speech case, and it's got to go to the Supreme Court, and they're going to have to adjudicate these kinds of cases with some clear language, or else free speech is over in America.
Absolutely.
Basically, they're taking what he's putting it in the context of his personal experience, what he's gone through, how his worldview has been impacted by his faith, and they're trying to say that disqualifies him to be the police chief of Atlanta, Georgia. He needs to take this all the way to the Supreme Court. I'm sure there's going to be lots of groups that are willing to support him in his effort. And basically, It's cases like this that are going to determine who we are going forward, whether or not the Constitution of the United States is meaningful anymore, or else it's going to be completely discarded by these fascist thinkers. And they believe in a totalitarian solution. That's the fancy phrase of saying, until they can control the way everybody thinks, the way everybody talks, the way everybody speaks, we're all going to be living in a chilled world.
Yes.
And you have to, they do not tolerate any kind of debate or dissension at all. I mean, this is scary.
It is, because if you look at the history of this fire chief, the article says that he's enjoyed nothing but praise from city and national leaders. He was Atlanta's fire chief in 2008. He actually joined the Obama administration as the U.S. fire administrator between 2009 and 2010, and he serves as a deacon in his Baptist church there. So everything he's done up to this point has been very much out in the open. He's been praised. But when he went and wrote this book, which he states in the article, he says, the references to homosexuality that the LGBT group is so adamantly and vehemently attacking him for, he says they took up about a half a page of his 160-page book. And he says both he and his supporters described the campaign against him as an effort to snuff out religious liberty. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about here. You can't have a country where you expect the freedom of speech to be limited to a specific group of people and consider it freedom of speech.
I like what he said, and this is really the truth, and this is where it's all going.
Yep.
Cochran said, I'm not discouraged and I'm not downtrodden. This is a God thing, and he's going to do great things, and he will vindicate me publicly. I think that's exactly the attack he needs to take. And he needs to much to their chagrin, keep it in that arena. And we're in a situation where either God's going to have to show up and show himself strong on behalf of those whose hearts are perfect toward him, or else religion's a crock anyway. Mm-hmm. So I guess we'll see.
Right.
These people want to basically throw down the gauntlet. Let's see what happens. And I don't know. God is, you know, he's had a way of showing himself throughout the ages, and something tells me this is just, this too shall pass, Doug.
Now, my question is, and I haven't heard, where is Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton? As religious leaders in the black community, why aren't they supporting this fire chief in his efforts to get his job back? Because, I didn't state it, but if you look at it, the fire chief is black. So where are those so-called leaders of the black community trying to support somebody that's being attacked for something that is guaranteed by the First Amendment, his freedom of speech and religion? So that's it for this week. We appreciate everybody listening. Stay tuned for Jake coming up next. And we'll be back next week. Until then, think wisely.